Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also faculty associate in law and public affairs, and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So much of our energy these days is focused on what's going on in Washington, and that's natural, given it's hard to turn away from it, that there's often not enough time to look at what's going on elsewhere, what's going on in local and state politics. Everything is told through the prism of President Trump, of partisan polarization in D.C., but it's important not to lose track of what's taking place all around, and even the impact of what's going on in Washington at the local level. So today, Sam and I are going to turn our attention to Alaska. We have with us today Bryce Edgman, an Alaska native and Democrat who is currently the Speaker of the House. He served in the Alaska House of Representatives for 10 years, where there is currently a independent governor, Bill Walker, and the Senate is controlled by the Republicans. Edgman is a former commercial fisherman and legislative aide, and he is the first speaker in Alaska with Alaska Native ancestry. Speaker Edgman, welcome to Politics and Polls.
Good morning. Glad I can be here.
So maybe we can start. It seems that interesting things have been happening in Alaska politics in the last few years. You have an independent governor, and you yourself are part of a tripartisan coalition in the House of Representatives. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what's been happening there.
Well, Alaska is a pretty independent state. I would point to our U.S. Senator, Senator Lisa Murkowski, getting reelected a couple of terms ago by a write-in campaign, a campaign that featured probably a fairly broad coalition of moderate voters, independent voters, Democrat voters that came together and really proved that that Alaska, when it comes to politics, more often than not goes its own way. And as you mentioned earlier, we do have an independent governor. And in the coalition that I represent in the House of Representatives, we have a pretty broad mix of individuals, including a small group of Republicans, a couple of independents, and a group of Democrats.
And how do these different groups here, what relationship do they bear to the National Party? I mean, you know, there's some travel time involved in getting to Alaska, and the idea of working across the aisle or forming any kind of coalition has really escaped the national government. It's just not in them, seemingly, to do that unless it's an absolutely desperate situation like a government shutdown. So can you just talk a little bit about the differences between what Alaska Democrats are like versus national Democrats, and same for Republicans?
Well, I think the version of Alaska Democrat or Alaska Republican has always differed to some extent from what it might be in other states. But in terms of our coalition, we came together, put party loyalties aside, the traditional caucus structure aside, and decided to join because Alaska is facing a historic budget gap and a fiscal situation facing a state that has for almost 40 years profited off of oil revenues that was able to essentially pay for most of the government services here in Alaska. But oil money now is drying up. And we need to make some really hard choices. And so a bunch of us got together and said, let's just sort of put the political parties aside. Let's form a coalition. You know, the first coalition of its nature in a very long period of time here in Alaska. And let's roll up our sleeves and try to fix the fiscal situation, which is exactly what we did in terms of the House's work last session here in our state capital in Juneau.
Now, that sounds so reasonable and rational, and yet we see again and again in many states and in Washington that doesn't happen, meaning big problem needs to
right,
be resolved.
Right, right. I asked him a question about what's different, and he said a bunch of rational stuff.
Right.
And see,
right.
As if that's an answer. Okay.
So let me ask. So I'm looking. So the coalition has three Republicans. How did they – and this, from my understanding, the Senate, the Republican Party, is more to the right. How did those three Republicans decide to break from the party and to join the coalition to deal with these issues?
Well, there was a small group of us that was in the former coalition, a Republican coalition in the House, and we had been there for a number of terms, and we really felt like that structure wasn't doing what it needed to do to address the fiscal situation. It, you know, and again, keep in mind that Alaska has been, you know, we've really had the good fortune of being able to rely on oil revenues to, again, pay for most of our state government services. And now we're at a time where we have to look at tough choices like new revenues. We've not had a broad-based tax measure in Alaska since 1981. And we have a large asset called the Permanent Fund that is now earning more money than any other source in Alaska, including the oil industry. And we're probably going to have to look in that direction as well in terms of using some of the revenue stream to pay for public safety and schools and education and everything else that we here in Alaska have come to depend on. So with this new coalition, we formed it around the thought that you know, we needed to take a strong approach, and we needed to have unique leadership. And so we put the small group that originally was in the former Republican-controlled majority, and we partnered with the Democratic minority, brought in some new legislators, and formed a coalition that I think has been working very well, very effectively.
And so this coalition is 17 Democrats, 3 Republicans, 2 independents. So I'm kind of curious about those Republicans there. What was it? Was it an appeal to principle that made them bolt their 21-seat majority?
I think it was an appeal to principle, but it was also sort of commonalities. The three Republicans in our coalition have all at one time or another represented smaller communities, coastal communities in Alaska. And so myself as a Democrat from Southwest Alaska, if you might picture where Aleutian chain sort of connects to mainland Alaska, that's the area of Alaska that I represent.
And that's the 37th district?
Yeah, House District 37. So we had a lot of common interests, and but first and foremost, in looking back at our time and previous coalitions, you know, we really felt strongly about putting the state's interests first. And I'll tell you, it's not easy to put, you know, we passed the income tax last session, for example. It is not easy to cast a vote of that nature and put yourself in the direct crossfire of many across the state. But
and that's the first state income tax in Alaska?
No, it's we did have an income tax from, I think, 1949 to 1981 in Alaska, and then all that got just sort of cast aside because oil revenues were starting to sort of flow into the state. And there have been other attempts to institute a state income tax in Alaska, and our measure only passed the House. It just fell flat on its face in the Senate last session.
And you mentioned the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Maybe you can tell our listeners what that is. I'm not sure people are familiar with that.
Yes. In 1976, the voters of Alaska, through an amendment to the state constitution, created essentially what became an endowment for oil royalties to be sort of put into this rainy day fund for, you know, some sort of use later on. And in 1982, the state created what's called a personal dividend check. So every eligible Alaskan, man, woman, and child in the state now gets an annual dividend payment. So the fund has grown over the years, and I think right now it's about $62.5, give or take, $1 billion. And the annual dividend this year was $1,100.
That was a cut.
It was a cut, and the governor 2 years ago actually cut the dividend funding in half, and the legislature this year, in turn, for the first time, appropriated essentially half of a dividend, knowing that, you know, money is getting really tight and that we need to look for the long term.
What's the idea behind the dividend? Is that like a minimum wage idea, or was there something else behind that? That's just interesting to hear that some government is doing something like that.
Yeah, it's very unique. I don't think there's anything like it in the country. I'm sure there is another model somewhere in the world. I'm not aware of it at this point.
Abu Dhabi or someplace.
Yeah, something like that. But the concept behind it was to take some of the oil wealth and to distribute it to individual Alaskan residents. And it's been very successful. And in the district that I represent, with a lot of smaller Alaskan Native villages, it's been a critical source of a household income.
So how do they feel about the fact that it went from, I'm looking at my sources here, in 2015 it was over $2,000, and in the 2 years since it's been more like $1,000. Hasn't that created some waves? I mean, that's got to be a hit on households.
Oh, it sure has. And, it's been very difficult. And myself and other members of our coalition have been working very diligently to sort of educate our constituents on the trade-offs involved and the need to, have a smaller dividend today so we can protect the future of the dividend and keep it in place for many years to come. But there's no question about it. A lot of Alaskans balk, but I think as time goes on, more Alaskans are realizing sort of the state of fiscal affairs and throughout Alaska and are taking a more reasonable approach to it.
And what if so the fiscal crisis that has been important to what you wanted to do in politics and to the formation of this coalition you're talking about, could you tell us what have some of the actual effects been beyond this cut that we're discussing in the dividend? What are some of the effects that you've seen on the state, on Alaska not having as much revenue in recent years?
Well, Alaska is a state that I think you can just sort of break it down into three pieces of the pie. One would be federal spending. Another would be the oil industry spending and the attendant economic impact. And then the third would be state government spending. But what we've seen as Alaska approaches, I think we're in the middle of our sixth year of deficit spending, but what we've seen is a slowing down of the economy. We have seen every sort of sign of recession, and we're seeing the construction industry, which had been on increase since 1988 for many years consecutively, now has flattened out. And I think we're also starting to see sort of a sense of urgency amongst the business community here in the state really wanting the legislature to take sort of the strong action that the House took last session and to really, put a viable long-term fiscal plan into place.
And one of the places there has been, from what I've read, a clash between what's going on in Alaska and what's going on in the Oval Office has to do with this the proposed pebble mine in southwest Alaska, and that the EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, had overruled some Clean Water Act protections. And what's going on with that issue right now?
Well, the pebble mine is in my house district, yep. So I'm very, very familiar with it. And it's, I think, eclipsing ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is sort of the highest profile resource development project in Alaska. And there's a lot of controversy, and a growing number of Alaskans are becoming concerned about it. And certainly it's a project that I oppose personally. It's why I jumped into politics and ran for the legislature in the first place. And I think it's something that people are looking at Administrator Pruitt is taking unilateral action after many years of putting together an EPA position that would have provided a more careful assessment of the project going forward.
And what would it mean if this went through? For those who don't understand this or who might read for a second about these rules changes, since you're from the district and you're representing it, what would this proposed change do? Why is it threatening?
Well, if you could picture this tiny corner of Alaska producing nearly half of all the sockeye salmon on the globe, and picture the very sensitive salmon habitat that sort of nurtures and provides environment for these salmon to go out to the ocean and to come back as healthy adults, and then put a large-scale, low-grade ore mine right in the middle of that habitat, and then say, oh, we can provide the environmental protections well into perpetuity to protect everything. That sort of creates the backdrop for why this thing is so controversial. And the EPA said, look, after consulting with a number of small Alaskan tribes in the region, they put together under the Clean Water Act some more stringent measures under what's called the 404C provision. And apparently, I think it's pretty clearly known at this point, with a new administration, an administrator who I believe will give every resource development project the benefit of the doubt no matter what, they are in the process of reversing those protections.
Well, let me back up a little bit here. So let's see. So it occurs to me that there's probably a special relationship between Alaska and the Environmental Protection Agency because of the huge reliance and interdependence on natural resources in Alaska. So you talk about the EPA administrator as if he's a principal official of the Trump administration. Over the years, has the EPA administration EPA administrator been a principal figure in Alaskan politics?
I wouldn't say so. We've had previous administrators actually travel to Alaska and become sort of familiar with the many dimensions that we have relationships with EPA, everything from small community wastewater systems to larger issues that the EPA is commonly deals with other states. So I would say yes and no.
Well, for instance, like let's say in a state like New Jersey, one might care about housing and urban development, and that might be less of a critical issue for Alaskans. So I'm just trying to get a feeling for ways in which Alaskans and the national government might be somewhat at odds, in fact. What about, I want to pivot just a little bit to climate change. So climate change is a domain where I would say that climate change is happening in most places on the planet. It obviously intersects with the oil industry. When people talk about climate change in Alaska, what do they talk about?
Well, of the 200 plus sort of scattered remote communities in Alaska, most of them not connected to a road system. You have to get in an airplane to fly out to these communities.
Wow.
All but about three or four of them are situated by a water body of some sort. So coastal erosion, the change in the storm patterns, the ice melting, permafrost starting to loosen up and melt and sort of move up north in the states. All these signs have been very visible indications that things are changing. And I'm born and raised in Alaska, and I can tell you when I was a kid, we used to get maybe one or two major storms coming off the Bering Sea under the coast of Alaska. Now we get them regularly, and we get them in December and then January in times of year we never got them before. So it's pretty clear that climate change is impacting Alaska. But at the same time, we're a resource development state, and the body politic throughout the state, you can say for better or for worse, is really acted to sort of look the other way and say, hey, look, it's really not that. It may be something else. But we're at the point now where, I think even the major industry forces in the state, and I should say I'm a supporter of resource development here in Alaska, but those, everybody's coming to the table saying, hey, look, we need to recognize it and take whatever action we can at this point.
Well, surely as the economy moves away somewhat from oil, then that power must become less dominant. And so that has to move more towards solutions that aren't always to the interest of the of oil development.
Well, that's right. We've depended upwards of 90% for oil revenue to fund state government. Last year, I think that number slipped down to about 30%. So we're looking at diverse
really?
Economy. Yeah, it's been the drop has been, in 2014, we had, $105 a barrel oil here in Alaska. And the snap of a finger, it dropped down to the next year to, don't quote me on this, but like $20, $30 a barrel. So the drop in oil revenue in the state has been sudden, it's been precipitous. And if it wasn't for a huge amount of savings that we've been able to accumulate, we would have had to take more drastic measures a long time ago.
Do you think it would seem politically that the reduction of the dividend, while not palatable to many people, would politically, it could be a very real thing to change the dynamics and the balance between resource development and climate change, because people at some level might feel they're literally receiving less money from the oil revenue. Could it have an effect like that?
I would say it could. You know, you look at the relationship between the national environmental community and what's happened in Alaska, everything from the Trans-Alaska pipeline to the timber industry to fishing activity in the Bering Sea, the pebble mine. Now we spoke about the Arctic wildlife, the ANWR item a few minutes ago. You know, I think those relationships, are going to be impacted going forward. There's just no question about it.
So the real emphasis, I would say, if we look at the national party, the national political parties seem to, one would broadly say that there's interest in resource development with both major parties, but Republicans have traditionally taken a fairly aggressive view towards resource development. Can we walk through just a little bit how local Democrats and local Republicans may differ from the national party? Like, what are acceptable ways to veer from party orthodoxy in the state of Alaska?
Well, I would start with the fact that Alaska is a resource development state. Mm-hmm. We don't have much manufacturing or sort of secondary processing in the state. So by and large, it's not uncommon to find Democrats and Republicans and independents all supporting a project like a drilling in the northern part of the state on the project called ANWR. But there are differences. There's no question. We talked about climate change a little bit ago. And now that our coalition is in place, we've actually held substantive legislative hearings on climate change. We'll probably be doing more of them. And the ethos did sort of change with our group in power in the House. And again, I think going forward with the very clear sort of changes at hand with climate variability or whatever you want to call it, I just think that we, as Alaskans, putting party politics aside, are going to have to come to grip that as a northern state at one point largely frozen with a lot of snow in the wintertime, now is finding that things are changing, and so, in some instances, pretty radically.
Sounds like a bright future for Alaskan agriculture.
It could be, and we do have a fair amount of agriculture and a lot more efforts to take advantage of some summers that are getting hotter, and some areas of the state that are getting more rainier.
And how do we understand? So, Senator Murkowski has become a pretty important player right now on Capitol Hill in creating problems for the Trump administration and offering part of a very thin center that has taken form. From your perspective, meaning from within Alaska, what drives her politics? Where exactly is she coming from within your area?
Well, it's for me, I guess, hazard a guess. I've not spoken directly to her about it, but let me just flat out say, she's a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. She does, former Senator Ted Stevens, a patriarch in the state for many, many years, and perhaps maybe the most influential Alaskan ever. She does what he always is about, which is to, say the hell with politics and put Alaska first. And so I'm proud of her. And if I could point to anybody being a role model for me or for anybody in our coalition, it might be her.
It's interesting that the Republican Party there can produce her and also produce Sarah Palin, very different kinds of Republicans.
Well, that's Alaskan politics for you.
How popular is Sarah Palin ever get talked about these days in any way?
No, I don't think so. Her profile is pretty low. I'm not even sure how much time she spends in the state. I understand that she spends a lot of time out of state. I don't think she's viewed, or probably doesn't, she doesn't desire to be viewed as a statewide political figure at this point.
Mm-hmm. What about other, just turning to national issues? I know that the United States, the lower 48 states, seems pretty far away at probably most of the time, but other national issues come up, and I'm curious about how they play out when people talk about politics in Alaska. Things like, say, access to health care, universal health care. Is that a thing that people talk about, or minimum wage? These are issues that you might imagine could cut across party lines, but they currently do not on the national scene. So I'm wondering if that looks any different from where you sit.
Well, you know, Alaska, some 740,000 people strong, in my view, and again, I'm from the rural end of things in the state, but about 70% of our population is, if you were to cut sort of a swath in the middle of the state, what we call the rail belt area, where Anchorage is connected to Fairbanks by road, and then you've got roads that connect Anchorage south to other bigger communities. And so, you know, the needs in that part of the state, I think, are very similar to any other sort of medium-sized city or medium densely populated area in the state, and I mean in the country. And you know, healthcare is definitely right at the top. I think Senator Murkowski, when I spoke with her a couple of months ago, had an opportunity to visit with her for about a half an hour, a personal visit. She said that healthcare was the number one issue that she heard when she came back to Alaska.
So it feels like she might be open to solutions that aren't necessarily at an identifiable place in the national party structure.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
You're a Democrat from a rural area, and we often hear that's a voice that's needed now within the national party as well as the state and local parties. What's your experience been in terms of how a Democrat can be appealing to rural communities in a way that Republicans cannot?
Well, I've always been an individual who's worked, you know, and tried to work with both both parties, and I've tried as well to keep true to my values. And you know, I think I would point to a lot of Alaskans. Politicians, legislators, whatever capacity that they're an elected official, to take in a similar approach. You know, we try to be practical. We try to work with everyone. But, you know, it's interesting, just like the rest of the country, social media and the ability for people on the outside to have a voice have also influenced things up here as well.
Say something good about the National Democratic Party or about Democratic values. I want to hear you say something good about that.
Well, their stance on healthcare, not losing any votes on the skinny repeal or buckling at all on the attempts to essentially disband Medicaid and Medicaid expansion. I was very proud of their efforts.
All right, that fits with the national party. I'm sorry to needle you, but let's try another one. Say something good about the rest of the 49 states. Because, well, you know, we're down here, too.
Well, you know, Alaska has a real close relationship with what we call the lower 48. And in Bristol Bay, for example, the commercial fishery, which is probably the largest salmon fishery in one area on the planet, is really comprised of a lot of people from different states throughout the country. And I travel regularly outside of Alaska and enjoy my relationship with a lot of non-Alaskans. So, you know, We try to be welcoming. We get a lot of visitors, 1.5 million tourists with the cruise ship industry last year. And, I think we interface quite a bit with the rest of the country.
Has everything in Washington, which I think everyone can agree has been unusual and somewhat turbulent, how has that impacted you as someone working at the state level? What are some of the ways in which you feel that play out in the kinds of decisions, policies, and politics that you need to deal with, especially since you're someone actually trying to move in a different direction with these bipartisan coalitions? Where has it created some instability and problems?
Well, on a per capita basis, Alaska gets, I think we're like number two or number three in terms of getting the most per capita federal funding. So the proposed Trump budget, which may or may not get any traction in Congress, has been a real source of concern up here. The military bases with instability in North Korea and elsewhere around the globe have been something that, has, I think, brought more scrutiny to Alaska. And so, you know, we keep a real close eye on what happens back east. And I think Alaska is pretty important to the rest of the country, too.
It's interesting. It's in the independent ethos of Alaska. Because from another perspective, it's a very democratic state, meaning you have lots of federal spending, you have sizable public infrastructure investment, from what I understand. You have a dividend, which is the closest I've heard to the
national income.
You have these pillars in the state, which are quite remarkable when you step back to see the role that government plays in the daily life of anyone living in Alaska.
Well, and it does shed a little bit more irony on our state sort of grappling with this monumental, historic sort of fiscal challenge that we have in front of us. And the term of the Alaska disconnect was given to it because, yes, we do get a lot of government services, both at the state and the federal level. And we've not, thankfully, had to pay too much for them because of the blessings from the oil industry. But now, as we try to, downsize the budget, we try to create new revenues, something to pick up that, where the oil industry left off. We're finding a lot of resistance and a lot of people wanting to really cut government spending dramatically in the state, but don't cut our schools or our troopers or, and our transportation projects. But don't tax me a nickel. And we don't think we should have to pay for any more than we're paying now.
I have a bottom line question for you here. The priorities are recognizable from the rest of the country, but yet uniquely Alaskan in their own way. Can you imagine a Democrat winning statewide, calling him or herself a Democrat? Like how would that play out?
Mark Begich, aided by a corruption scandal with then Senator Stevens, was elected as the U.S. Senator, the Democrat, and that was in 2008. So it can happen in the state. And I don't know if we're similar to, North Dakota or Montana or some other states where, generally the politics are right-leaning, but a strong centrist with the across-the-board appeal can actually win. And I would not be shocked if it were to happen sometime, in the near future.
Well, Trump only won Alaska by less than 15 percentage points. And so in that respect, Alaska is closer than, say, the Dakotas.
Well, and I think Barack Obama, a couple of cycles ago, did very well in Alaska as well. And again, I would point to the fact that our demographics, 70% of the population is sort of clustered in the middle of the state, and the rest of the state is these small rural outlying communities largely comprised of Alaskan natives.
Well, that actually wraps up our episode. And we both want to thank Speaker Bryce Edgman from Alaska for joining us and having this very thoughtful conversation. So thank you for being part of our show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.